So if you're with us today for the first time or you haven't been with us in a while, we're going through a series called Knowing God. And this really is looking at some key attributes and characteristics of God to help us understand who we are and then what we should be about. And the more I thought about this is so crucial because I think we live in a world that oftentimes thinks that they know best about themselves. But the reality is the only way to understand who you truly are, the only way to understand your purpose in life, the only way to understand your mission is to understand God first. You must start with him. And starting with him and putting him at the center, that defines everything else. And so that's what we're doing. We are looking at him to define ourselves and what we're about. So we looked at different attributes like the love of God, the truth of God, the grace of God, those kind of things. Today we're going to look at the suffering of God. The suffering of God. Now, before we jump into this, I just want to clarify, the reality is we could do a 3 or 4 part series about this, and we don't have time for that. So inevitably, at the end of the message, I'm going to leave out certain things that you might have wished I touched on or questions that seem like or big ones that didn't get addressed, and I just want you to know that that wasn't left out intentionally. We just don't have time to cover that. Now, the second thing is that the suffering of God may seem like a strange thing to look at, right? Because when we think about God, we oftentimes think more of his might or his power or his holiness or his majesty. And so in some ways, it seems a little odd to look at the suffering of God. And philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche, who did not believe in God in the 19th century, famous philosopher, this even posed an issue for him. He referred to it as the ghastly paradox. And when it came down to God's suffering for human beings, he said, then suddenly we come face to face with that paradoxical and ghastly expedient, God's sacrifice of himself for man. The creditor offers himself as a sacrifice for his debtor out of sheer love, out of love for his debtor. And it shocked Nietzsche and it shocks others, and that suffering seems strange. And I think as we look at it, though, it really is helpful to see it as an answer from God, an answer from God for our questions. And we are people that question, right? No matter what our circumstances or events that we have, we always question. We're searching for meaning, purpose, and all those things. I think back of when my kids were younger, and if you're a parent, your kids went through that questioning stage, right? Why, right? Why is the sky blue, and why this, and then as we got a little bit older, you know, they wandered into questions about, well, where do babies come from? So that leads to a discussion as well. A lot of questions, and kids do that, but then as grown-ups, we do the same thing, right? I mean, we get into difficult circumstances, and we start asking a lot of questions. And I think there's no other time when we start asking questions than when we go through suffering, when we go through difficult times. We ask the infamous questions, why me, God? Or why now? This seems like the worst possible time. How could this be happening right now? And we're looking for answers in our suffering. We're looking for some kind of meaning to our coherence, to put it all together. Maybe it's a loss of a job or a spouse's health or cancer or a house fire or an accident that just happened. And it reminds me a lot of the most famous story in the Bible of suffering, Job, who went through incredible suffering, where his family died, his house was completely destroyed, his crops were destroyed all in one day. And if you read the book of Job, you have a man who, although outright never defies God, certainly has a lot of questions for God about why this happened and why he was born, and he struggles with it. But at the end of the book, what's really interesting about Job is that he never gets an answer for what he went through. This horrific season, these horrific events at the end of the book, Job never gets an answer of why it happened. But he does get an answer, and the answer is God himself. It is God himself. It is him suffering for us. That is Job's answer. In his book, Making Sense Out of Suffering, Peter Kreft, the philosopher, writes, God didn't give us a placebo or a pill or good advice. He gave us himself. He came. He entered space and time and suffering. God's answer oftentimes is himself. But where do we see this? I mean, where do we see God suffer? Where do we see him endure this? And I think we see it best when he came to live amongst us, when he took upon human flesh. We see it most prevalently in the life of Jesus Christ, of his life being lived out. And you know what's really interesting? When I survey the Gospels, and I read through the Gospels, and I read about Jesus' life, one of the most dominant themes in the Gospels of Jesus' life is suffering. And that should shock us. I mean, to think about all the things that Jesus taught, all the things that he did, one of the most common themes you see the whole time is suffering, both in what he taught to people about suffering, and then what he endured in his own life was suffering. So where do we see it? Well, a couple examples. First, we see it in people's hatred of him, people's hatred of Jesus. John 1:10-11 says, he was in the world, and though the world was made through him, the world did not recognize him. He came to that which was his own, but his own did not receive him. His own did not receive him. Even Jesus himself, our creator, comes and he's rejected. And all throughout the Gospels, over and over and over again, you get people who really hate Jesus, especially the religious leaders who despise Jesus. And there's this constant hatred for him. The second thing you see about suffering in his life is that he absorbed the wrongs and sin of other people. You know what's amazing? If you look at Jesus' ministry in the Gospels, you see him healing people who have diseases, both in the physical sense, and then you also see him taking upon himself sin. The thing is, when he was doing all of this stuff, he was removing from someone else what their malady or suffering was, and then he was placing it upon himself. It was as though the people were going around with these sacks on their backs, with all these issues and problems and suffering, and Christ would see this person, he would take it off of their shoulders and then put it onto his. He was going around constantly absorbing wrongs. And if you look at this, the most profound section of Scripture that deals with this is Isaiah chapter 53. If you have a Bible, you can open up there, Isaiah chapter 53. And I'm just going to read verses 2-12. And it's a little bit longer section, but I want you to see just how profound Jesus' suffering is in here and how he absorbs wrongs. Isaiah, this was written 720 years before Christ ever came. This is one of the most amazing prophecies ever given for Jesus. In chapter 53, verse 2, it says, he grew up before him like a tender shoot and like a root out of dry ground. He had no beauty or majesty to attract us to him, nothing in his appearance that we should desire him. Now listen to the descriptions about him. He was despised and rejected by men. Just stop right there and think of your life. Has it ever been the case in your life that you could say people have despised you? That people outright hated you? I think for many of us, not. I think we haven't experienced anything even close to that. But here we have a man who was despised by people and completely rejected by them. Second, a man of sorrows and familiar with suffering. Just think of that for a moment. Familiar with suffering. Could that be described of your life? You are well acquainted with suffering. You've walked hand in hand over long periods of time with suffering. Jesus knew it like the back of his hand. That's how well he knew suffering. Like one from whom men hide their faces. Could you imagine that at your work tomorrow, at your school, that when you walk into it, people would hide their face to look at you because you're so despised and rejected? He was despised and we esteemed him not. Surely he took up our infirmities and carried our sorrows. Yet we considered him stricken by God, smitten by him and afflicted. But he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. The punishment that brought us peace was upon him, and by his wounds we are healed. We all, like sheep, have gone astray. Each of us has turned to his own way, and the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. He was oppressed and afflicted, yet he did not open his mouth. He was led like a lamb to the slaughter, and his sheep before the shears is silent, so he did not open his mouth. By oppression and judgment he was taken away, and who can speak of his descendants? For he was cut off from the land of the living. For the transgression of my people he was stricken. He was assigned a grave with the wicked, and with the rich in his death, though he had done no violence, nor any deceit was in his mouth. Nothing wrong, and yet he took all of it. Yet it was the Lord's will to crush him and cause him to suffer. And though the Lord makes his life a guilt offering, he will see his offspring and prolong his days, and the will of the Lord will prosper in his hand. After suffering of his soul, he will see the light of life and be satisfied. By his knowledge, my righteous one servant will justify many, and he will bear their iniquities. Therefore, I will give him a portion among the great, and he will divide the spoils with the strong, because he poured out his life unto death and was numbered with the transgressors. For he bore the sin of many and made intercession for the transgressors. Unbelievable section of Scripture. Unbelievable. That here we have Jesus, a man who was sinless and innocent, and yet completely described as crushed, bearing all of our iniquities and absorbing all of our wrongs. I can't think of someone who suffered more. He's like a sponge that you clean up the dirt and the gunk and the filth. And his life absorbed all the gunk and dirt and filth. The third thing is this, is that his suffering is seen ultimately in the greatest display of all, in the cross, which you spent our time singing about. One of the most powerful moments I've had in my life in this regard is a service, a Good Friday service I was at in Bellingham back in college. And the pastor really wanted to bring home the point to people about the just horrific nature of the cross. You know, we have the tendency to hear about it, read about it in our book, but it's so much different to see it, right? And if you've seen the movie The Passion, I mean, that made you almost want to throw up, seeing how just violent it was and how awful. And the pastor there really wanted to bring it home, though. It's one thing to read about it. It's another thing to see someone go through something like that. And so at the Good Friday service, he got a huge cardboard box, and he brought this massive cardboard box, and he put it up on the stage. And then weeks earlier, he had formed a whip that like they had used on Jesus when they flogged him. And from everything that you do, that we look at in history to determine the whip that was used, and we're able to determine a lot about it, it not only was a whip with leather strands, but they also would have balls of iron they'd put in the ropes, and then shards of broken bone. And so when the whip would hit a person, it would not only sting with the leather, but it would pound in their flesh with the iron, and the bone would then rip flesh off. And then in front of all the people in this moment, the pastor gets up there, and he takes his whip, and he whips this cardboard box. And I can't explain the thunder of that thing smacking the box and then ripping off shreds of that box. And over he whipped that thing. And it was the most gut-wrenching thing ever. I mean, there was not a dry eye in the whole service. It was so visceral to see that this what it was like and to understand that that was his suffering. Actually, only a glimpse. I mean, that was just the start of it. Then for him to go and get beaten and have a crown of thorns put on his head, hit with a stick like that, and then ultimately to go and have 8-9-inch nails driven into your hands and feet, and then to be posted up and then to suffocate ultimately on the cross, heaving there for 6 hours. I mean, it's beyond anything that we could ever imagine. In Mark 10, 33 through 34, Jesus says, "We're going up to Jerusalem," he said, "and the Son of Man will be delivered over the chief priests and the teachers of the law. They will condemn him to death and will hand him over to the Gentiles, who will mock him and spit on him, flog him and kill him. 3 days later, he will rise." And this is not just once, but over and over and over in the Bible, Jesus constantly talks about this incredible moment of going to the cross. And I would argue the greatest display ever of his suffering. And as David Crowder said in our song, our victory. You know, the amazing thing about this, though, in the ways that God displayed his suffering, the amazing thing about it is that he didn't have to do it. I mean, if you think about the vast majority of our suffering as people, is it not something that we didn't choose? Is it not almost always events that happen to us or people around us that do things to us? Or we rarely, if ever, have a choice of enduring suffering, and if we're all honest, we wouldn't choose it, right? I mean, who of us would actually choose that? But the crazy thing is, God did. He didn't have to do it. He didn't have to come down. He could have sent us a book and said, read it and good luck, right? He could have, but he didn't. The sheer craziness that he would choose willingly to come and to suffer in the way he did and live a life familiar with suffering should just crush us inside that he would do that for us. Why would he do that? Why would God do that for us? And I think we get a small glimpse in the life of a human. George Tyson is his name, and George Tyson is a British man. And a couple years ago, he was walking on this road with his son, who was pushing along in a wheelchair. And his son, when he was young, about 18 months old, fell and had a brain injury. And so he was injured for his whole entire life. And he had to be in a wheelchair and had 24/7 care his whole life. So even in that, at this point in the story, his son's like 32 years old. So 32 years old, this man, this father, George, has been caring for his son, Gary. And yes, obviously he would say that it was, he loves his son and he wanted to take care of him. But let's be honest, it would also be a tremendous sacrifice to do that, to give up a lot of things that he didn't do to take care of his son. So already he's sacrificed a great deal. Well, as they're on this road and he's wheeling him along, all of a sudden he hears this sound and he turns around to see a car that's going completely out of control, flying down the road, and literally in a split second, he takes his son and he pushes him out of the way and the car slams into him and kills him. And his son, Gary, wound up going to the hospital and he had a couple of scratches and he came back home. And here's a father who literally gave up his life for his son. And we hear that story and we wonder, well, why would he do that? And we all know the answer, and it's love. That kind of love literally gave up his life for someone else. And if you see that in a human being who suffered, how much more is that true in God? How much more is that true of the indescribable love he has for you and me that would bring him to the point that he would suffer beyond imagination? If you ever have doubted ever once in your life, does God love me? Just look at his suffering. That is his answer to you of does God love me? Well, how does God's suffering, his suffering, help us understand our suffering? How does it put into perspective the kind of suffering that we go through, whether physical suffering or emotional or spiritual or whatever it might be? And I think it helps us understand in a couple different ways. First, helps us understand because it shows us that if God suffered and Jesus suffered, we will suffer. Many times the gospel of Jesus talks about that, a servant is not greater than his master. And that if I endured something, that you will endure the same thing. John 16:33, Jesus says, I've told you these things so that in me you may have peace. In this world you will have trouble, but take heart, I have overcome the world. And I think when we hear that verse, we so often run to the last part about taking heart to overcome the world, or the first part where Jesus gives us peace, and we miss the middle part. In this world, you will have trouble. And we sometimes forget, that's not saying may or it might. He's saying you will have trouble. You will have a difficult life. You are going to suffer. And, frankly, I think one of the most biggest disservices we do to people who ever come to Christ is we paint some picture that coming to Christ is somehow going to mean that your life is going to get better. The truth is, tell that to a first century Christian. Tell that to them who when they became a Christian, they put a target on their back that you will die for this, that you're going to die for this. You know, I've talked to so many Christians, too, who've become a Christian, and frankly, their life got way worse. It got way worse. The issues with their family got worse. Struggles in their own life got worse. It wasn't like it got better. And I think just so often we have this kind of Western mindset that somehow being a Christian, yes, there's going to be struggles and stuff like that, but somehow equals this sort of easy life. I would argue, in fact, the Bible says the almost the opposite, that becoming a Christian actually signs you up for a more difficult life, a much more difficult life. Jesus said in John 15:18-20, if the world hates you, keep in mind that it hated me first. If you belong to the world, it would love you as its own. As it is, you did not belong to the world, but I have chosen you out of the world. That is why the world hates you. Remember what I told you, a servant is not greater than his master. If they persecuted me, they will persecute you also. And 2 Timothy 3:10-12, Paul says, you, however, know all about my teaching. This is to Timothy. My way of life, my purpose, my faith, patience, love, endurance, persecutions, and sufferings. What kinds of things happened to me in Antioch, Iconium, and Lystra, the persecutions I endured. Yet the Lord rescued me from all them. And he says this, in fact, everyone who wants to live a godly life in Christ Jesus will be persecuted. I'll say that again. In fact, everyone who wants to live a godly life in Christ Jesus will be persecuted. We need to take that to heart. And yes, I recognize in 21st century America, the reality is persecution for us is not that big a deal. You might get made fun of at school or teased at work. And that's about the extent. But it is vastly changing. And I think as Christians, we have to recognize that, again, for a first century or second century or third century Christian, persecution to the point of dying was normal. That was normal. And I know we don't have really any concept of that, but that was normal. The power of the gospel is not to transform our circumstances, but to transform us in our circumstances. To transform us in our circumstances so that we might face suffering, and yet, as Jesus said, take peace and take heart in the middle of it. The other thing is this, second thing is this, God's suffering, I think, also helps us understand. It produces good things in us. It produces good things in us. A basketball camp I was part of when I was younger, they had all these kind of great sayings that they would use at the basketball camp. And one of the sayings they would use, they had an acronym, PPG. PPG. And it stands for pain produces gain. You know, as you're running a bunch of lines, and you're down in defensive stance for 20 minutes, you're like, that doesn't produce gain. This pain sucks. This is horrible. But then at the end of the basketball season, as you're able to run a lot better and you have a lot of endurance and strength, you're like, well, maybe pain does produce gain. Maybe it actually does. And the same way, it's true that suffering can produce gain. It can produce great things inside of us. Romans 5:3 says, not only so, but we also glory in our sufferings because we know that suffering produces perseverance, perseverance character, and character hope. And the same way, James 1:2-4, it says, consider it pure joy, my brothers and sisters, whenever you face trials of many kinds, because you know that the testing of your faith produces perseverance. Let perseverance finish its work so that you, may be mature and complete, not lacking anything. And our good friend C.S. Lewis said, God whispers to us in our pleasures, speaks in our conscience, but shouts in our pains. It is his megaphone to rouse a deaf world. Man, there's nothing like suffering to do a great work in us. You know, have you ever been going through something, though, that's really been tough, that's been stressful or painful or discouraging or horrible or a tragedy, and in the middle of it thought, this is hands down the worst thing I've ever gone through, or this is one of the worst things that I've had to go through, right? And it seems awful. whether it's the loss of a job or an injury or a rebellious teenager or a dark night of the soul that we all go through. And it's tiring, it's exhausting, it's painful, it's hard, and then we say this is just a horrible thing. And then all of a sudden, 5, 10 years later, as you look back on that, you say, you know what, that was really difficult, but man, God did some great things in my life because of it. Haven't we all experienced that? Isn't it true? I mean, we do. We look back and we say, yes, I wouldn't have chosen that. I would not have chosen to go through what I did. But the truth is, God could have never got me to the place where I'm at. He could have never done that thing in my life. He could have never done those things if I wouldn't have gone through that. And we all know that's true. And it's that truth, that transformation and change and character development and us being conformed into Christ rarely happens in times of comfort, right? Yet that's what we almost always pursue. I mean, when's the last time you heard someone say, you know what, those 6 weeks sitting on the beach in Maui really helped me develop a lot in my life? You know? I don't think I've ever heard that from someone. But I have heard people say things like, yeah, taking second place in that competition, which I didn't really want to, showed me some things about myself that I needed to face. Showed me some things in my life that I knew that were there, but that issue brought them out. I do want to say a couple things about this, though, that are really important. First is this. I don't want to minimize someone's suffering. I think sometimes something that we do all the time as Christians is that we kind of have this idea that, hey, whatever you're going through, God's doing something good in it. And that might be true, but frankly, if you're going through it, that doesn't always sound great. And that doesn't just all of a sudden relieve the suffering. That doesn't just like change it. Like, oh, awesome, thanks. I'm going through a horrible time in my life, but God's doing something great in it. And sometimes you go through horrible tragedies that we see around us too that frankly don't look like that at all. They're horrible. Whether it's a natural disaster and numerous people died, or we go through something in our own lives like the loss of a child or something, and we're like, you know what? Please don't tell me God's doing something good in this. This looks like there's nothing. And let's just be honest and not, I don't think, try and always put some positive spin on something for people. And just like Job's friends, just sit with someone. Just be present with someone. And not always have to try and frame it in a positive light or put something spin on it. Just be present. Just sit with someone and go through what they're going through. So if that's where you're at today, I don't want you to please hear me to say, hey, buck up, you know, God's doing something awesome in you in your life. That may be true, but I want you to know, I understand, and we as a church understand exactly where you're at. And we're going to be here. I think when those things happen too, when we encounter these tragedies where it's like, doesn't see anything good going on through it, I think the one lens we have to look at is the cross. We have to look at the cross. Because it's the one place where you can see, no matter how deep and black and dark my tragedy is, God went to the cross for me, and God suffered the ultimate for me. So I can know, even how bad this is, it cannot be because he doesn't love me. It cannot be because he's indifferent to me. It cannot be because he's absent from me. It must be something else. But I know he loves me. I know he entered into our lives to walk with me. I know that must be true. We've got to see it through the cross. The second thing is this. It's important, if you notice the way I phrased this point, was that it can produce gain. Suffering can produce gain. It doesn't automatically produce gain. In fact, it often produces the opposite in people. Some of you here today, I almost guarantee, have gone through really awful things. And because of it, in heart of hearts, there's anger against God. There's resentment against God. There is deep-seated, how could you abandon me? At that point in my life, of all things, how could you have done that? And to never think suffering doesn't automatically produce good. It comes about by a choice. Again, go back to Job. I mean, of all people,
It seems like Job had every right to look at God and say, how could you? You are a horrible God. Look at my life. It's an absolute disaster. And of all that, in all of Job, he never once does that. Yes, he pours out his heart. Yes, he pours out his questions. Yes, he pours out his anger, his frustration. But the whole time, he continues the pursuit towards God. And I just want you to know, you have a choice to make. You have a choice to make. Again, I would say we have to look at the cross. That, again, the answer that God gives you may not be the answer you want, but the answer that he gives us over and over is himself. Himself. The third one is this, is we know from his suffering that Christ suffers with us. Christ suffers with us. I think it's evident from what we've seen in Jesus' life that he has suffered more than any of us ever will. And even if it's something that you've gone through that's really been horrible, the reality is we know Jesus bore the entire sin of the whole world on his back. And again, I don't say that to try and minimize anyone going on, but just the truth that Jesus has certainly suffered more than any of us ever will or have. And so we know that he must understand our plight. He must understand what we are going through. He must understand the depth of it. There's an architectural firm down in Dallas called D2 Architecture. And they're a firm that builds large homes for people who are older. And so whether it's assisted living homes or other homes for people who are in the latter part of life, they build these homes. And the head architect guy, his name's David Dillard, he had all these young architects that were coming in from college and started working for him, and they would design these buildings. And they'd be looking at their textbooks, and they'd be looking at their drawings, they would design these books. And David Dillard was like, you know, it seems like whenever we design these buildings that we're like missing something, that we're missing things. And so he designed the idea of having sleepovers. And what those were is that he made a policy that any new person coming into his firm, that you had to spend 24 hours in one of these homes that you were going to design. And he called it a sleepover. So these 20-something-year-old architects had to go to this, you know, assisted living home, and they had to be there for 24 hours. Now, here's the thing. It wasn't just going there and sitting in some room. You had to actually function as though you were someone living there. So they would go in there, and they did a couple different things. One, they had to wear earplugs to simulate hearing loss. They had to tape their fingers together so they could simulate, you know, someone who has arthritis or issues with their hands to be able to move. They had to exchange eyeglasses with other people, or they would not wear their glasses to simulate, you know, a blindness and issues with vision. They had to eat really poor diets because oftentimes the food was not very good in there. They had to tie their shoes with one hand. Oftentimes people couldn't use both their hands. So had to tie shoes with one hand, or they had to put on their clothes with only one hand. There were all these things that made them live like someone there. And then they would come back and they would keep a journal of this. So they had a journal the whole time they would keep. And then when they returned, they would turn in the journal and then they would look through the journal. And it was amazing, all these things that they discovered from walking in the shoes of the people who were living in these homes. Some practical things, they learned about the windows being a little bit higher. They found out that a lot of times people weren't able to see out of the windows, and it provided a little bit of light and some beauty. They noticed, too, about having walkways. Some of the walkways were not very even, and those who were a lot older couldn't lift their feet up very much. They would trip and fall. And so they found all these really cool things because they actually walked in their shoes. And at the end of it all, Dillard, the guy, he said the biggest benefit is that when I send 27-year-olds out, they come back with a heart 10 times as big. They meet people and understand their plights. And just like them, we have a God who's walked in our shoes. We have a God just like these 27-somethings that has walked in our shoes. Hebrews 4, 14 through 16 says, therefore, since we have a great high priest who has ascended into heaven, Jesus, the Son of God, let us hold firmly to the faith we profess. For we do not have a high priest who is unable to empathize with our weaknesses, but we have one who has been tempted in every way, just as we are, yet he did not sin. Let us then approach the throne of God's grace with confidence, so that we may receive mercy and find grace to help us in our time of need. We have a Father who's walked in our shoes in every capacity. And yes, he may not have gone through the exact circumstance that you're going through, but he has gone through so much more. And so we have a Christ who's able to sympathize with us in everything. And this completely crushes the idea that God does not care about my suffering, or see my suffering, or even can relate to my suffering. Again, he chose to endure suffering. Not that he had to, but he chose it. He knows it truthfully far better than you and I ever will. And he understands exactly where you are. My daughter, about a week ago, we went through a pretty sick season for about a week. Our family was really sick. My younger daughter got sick, and then I got sick, as you guys know, a couple Sundays ago. And then my older daughter came back on that weekend, and she had strep throat. And for those of you who ever had that before, it's really bad, right? And the first couple days, the first day especially, she was laying on the couch, and literally, I mean, couldn't even move. I mean, she just laid there. And those of you who are parents know to see a child in sickness is just a horrible thing. And especially with strep throat, I mean, you know, your throat is just horrible pain. It was like pins and needles. She couldn't even talk. She was saying it was so bad in her throat. And my heart just went out to her to see her like that. It was so sad, you know, and she could barely walk around, and she had a fever and everything. And she goes to bed that night, and she gets up. My daughters are in bunk beds, and so she's up on the top bunk. And I get on the stool like I do every night, and we talk for a second and pray and stuff like that. And I just told her, and she's laying there, and her eyes are all bloodshot, and she just looks horrible. And I said, honey, I said, you know, I said, if I could, I would take this from you, and I would take it onto me, that I would take your strep throat. And she looked at me, and just tears started to come in her eyes. And she's like, you would do that? And I said, yes, in a heartbeat. I would take that pain in my throat. I'll take that hurt in my body for you. I'll take your strep throat. And it just touched her, and you could tell she was like, wow, I think you would do that for me. And I think of Jesus, and, you know, he's taken so much more than our strep throat. He's taken everything. He's taken our failures, our abuse, our lies, our pride, our envy, our jealousy, our hurts, our sufferings, our addictions. And he put it on him, on his own self. You know, the suffering of God, I hope you hear loud and clear, is driven ultimately by his love. It's by his love. Why would I take my daughter's strep throat? It's because I love her. And he loves you enough to suffer the worst. Let's pray. Lord, I know that there are many of us here today, God, who came in this morning not knowing what we were going to be talking about. And many of us, Lord, who I think are exactly in this place. And we all come at different levels. Some of us are maybe going through some small tragedy or difficulty, but others of us are going through really difficult things. And God, it's just to meet you here, Lord, and to know that you are right beside us in our suffering. And it makes you think of other religions, God, and who have a God who's so far away, so far removed from humanity that they would never expose themselves to any kind of dirt or filth or those kinds of things. And yet we have before us a God who not only just came down to enter into our world, but picked up our dirt, picked up our junk, took all of it, God, and put it on your own self. It is unbelievable. And I pray to God today that we would be so touched, so profoundly impacted by how much you've suffered for us. And to know that, yes, we may not get an answer for what we're going through. And it may look like there's no answer in sight. And it may look even meaningless for what we're having to endure. Some of us, for decades, we've had to endure things. But I pray today, God, that the answer that you do give is yourself. And for us just to lay down whatever our anger is, our resentment, maybe our bitterness, some of us for the first time today, I pray, God, just to confess and with honesty and just say, I have been angry at you, God. I have been bitter towards you. I do feel like you robbed me. But today I choose to take all of my anger and fear and bitterness and just cast it upon you. We don't have answers, but we do have you. And you are enough. Your suffering on our behalf is enough. To know that you've gone to the greatest extent for us. I pray too, Father, that your example would be the example for us. That we would not to seek to live lives of comfort. And not that we choose suffering. We're not choosing it for our own sake. That would be sick and disturbing. We don't choose that. But we just pursue you and accept suffering when it comes, knowing that that is part of the Christian life. And that we would endure it, Father, and bear it just like you bore it for us, so that you might transform us, God, into the people you've called us to be. We love you, Jesus, so much. We literally owe everything to you. In your name, Jesus, amen.